Thank you very much. Marshall, if you can call court to order, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Reyes, Judge Frisch, Judge Halbrooks, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, November 4th, 2021. We have three cases set for oral argument today and then one set for a non-oral calendar. The first case we have on our calendar today is A21-0506. LeBlanc versus Homer. And forgive me if I have mispronounced either one of those names. Just want to check real quick to make sure that both attorneys, that we can see you. Just want to make sure that we can hear you okay, counsel for appellant. If you could just acknowledge.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Thank you. I can hear you clearly. And attorney for respondent.
I can hear you just fine, Your Honors.
Okay, perfect. We are holding this by zoom.gov this audio is being recorded, but no other recordings are allowed because we are doing this virtually, and we certainly appreciate all of you attending this virtually. If we do run into any issues at all, we will make sure that we accommodate those from time to time, as all of you, I'm sure, are aware. Once in a while, issues may come up, technical problems or technical issues. I've had my share this morning already myself, so we certainly understand. In terms of the process, we will allow 15 minutes for oral arguments by appellant. That will be followed by 15 minutes for respondent and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. We will be observing all rules of court, except, of course, you don't have to worry about standing because we're not in the courtroom itself. And we have a clock. You should be able to see it, a timer, so you know how much time you have. Please be aware of that, especially when it comes down to the last minute or two, to make sure that you stay within your time. With that, we will go ahead and proceed. Appellant, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. You may begin your argument.
May it please the court, honorable judges. This is Gerald Wallace, attorney for the appellant, Philip Homer. The Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas once said, common sense makes good law. The appellant here has raised four issues, whether or not there's sufficient evidence to have granted the respondent petitioner, Ms. LeBlanc, an order for protection, whether there was sufficient evidence to grant an order for protection for the minor child, GJH, whether there was sufficient evidence to grant an order for protection and restrict the parenting time of Mr. Homer, the appellant, for the other minor child, ECH, and whether or not parenting time should have been restricted for ECH and the appellant. In the appellant's view, the facts here do not support the issuance of the order for protection for Ms. LeBlanc. The appellant went to International Falls to pick up their children pursuant to their regularly scheduled parenting time order. The appellant had with him his own separate children from a different relationship and was there to pick up the two children he shares with Ms. LeBlanc. Ms. LeBlanc at that point in time did not like the seating situation in the appellant's car and started to object and become physically aggressive with the respondent. The respondent went to take their daughter and place their daughter into his vehicle. There's disagreement as to how the daughter was placed into the vehicle. The respondent believes that he picked her up, cradled her into the vehicle, and the respondent, Ms. LeBlanc, continued to follow him. at which point in time, the respondent, Ms. LeBlanc, shoved him, and he left that situation and was leaving when Ms. LeBlanc put her arm into the vehicle in between the door and the frame of the vehicle. And
Mr. Wallace?
Yes.
With all due respect, sir, I mean, I understand your client's recitation of the events here, but the district court did make credibility determinations and found that mom's description of the events were more credible, and then used words like grab the child, forcibly picked her up, hauled her. And so are you saying that those are clearly erroneous findings that are not supported by the record?
That's one argument, Your Honor. Another argument here would be, and I think more appropriate given the law, is in the context and in the circumstances here, whether or not the granting of this order for protection was appropriate as it relates to the children.
It looks to me from the order that the order for protection was actually only entered as to the one child. It wasn't entered as to the second child.
Then I'll move to GJH at this point in time, Your Honor. And addressing the issue with GJH, the transcript, I think, is clear that there isn't a link between the actions of the appellant and the injury in this particular case.
But what about the district court's fine? I mean, I appreciate that argument, counsel, and I understand the nuance there. But what I'm focusing on is on the second page of the district court, or on the last page of the district court's order, the district court judge talks about how the actions of your client would have instilled fear in a reasonable person, including the child. And so why isn't that sufficient to sustain the OFP in this particular case?
Well, Your Honor, my position would be that there's no specific findings here and there's no testimony to support that the child wasn't in fear. The statute doesn't discuss a reasonable person standard and doesn't allow, I believe, a court to substitute its determination, its belief of what a specific fact is for what a specific fact is that actually occurred. The second page of the order, that particular paragraph, in my opinion, Judge Tremoyan makes an opinion finding and believes that the child was in fear. Whether or not the child was in fear of imminent physical harm is an issue of factual finding for the court to make if there's testimony or evidence to support that factual finding. In this particular case, there was none. There was an assumption by the district court fear was in fact the case. And so,
Wallace,
yes,
I want to ask you specifically following up on Judge Frisch's questions. I mean, the district court in its order says, referring to his daughter, grabbing her by the waist and hauling her to the car meets the definition of domestic abuse due to her abdominal surgery 2 days earlier, of which the dad was clearly aware. And so why would that not be satisfactory with respect to the requirement of the statute?
Picking up and carrying a child who's suffered an injury, I don't believe is sufficient, Your Honor. In order to harm, the word harm itself, Your Honor, I think is important here. There has to be something that happens because of an action. I think the statute is clear. It uses the words commit and against, you know, commit meaning to perpetrate, against meaning not for someone, right? In opposition to them. In this case, that's it. Even if you accept the district court's finding of fact on the issue, I don't believe that picking up a child or hauling them, as they said, supports a order for protection in this particular case, because that's not physical harm. The physical harm that the district court found was this subsequent surgical infection. And the testimony to support the finding of that physical harm is that whatever the appellant did, quote unquote, did not help the situation. That's not a direct quote, but did not help. And consequently, I don't believe that that's sufficient to support the finding of physical harm. that infection has been present prior to whatever the appellant did. I'm sorry, Judge Reyes.
Sure, not a problem. I just want to follow up on this line of questioning, because as Judge Frisch, I think, correctly points out, I mean, the district court made credibility findings, and generally we don't review credibility findings. We defer to the fact finder, and here it's the district court. And you referred several times to appellants carrying the child, but that was not a finding by the district court. And as Judge Hallbrooks points out, the language by the district court is, quote, grabbing her by the waist, not carrying her, but grabbing her by the waist. He knew she just had abdominal surgery. So why isn't that sufficient? The finding of grabbing her by the waist, knowing that she had abdominal surgery, and then subsequently, that is enough to meet the definition of domestic abuse and harm.
It's not clear that the grabbing caused any harm. There is, I think, despite the respondent's argument, there has to be a causal connection here between an action and the result of that action.
Okay, but let me just stop you there for a second. I mean, you quoted prior justice of common sense makes good law. How is it not common sense that if somebody had abdominal surgery and you grab somebody by the waist, that might not cause harm to that person? That's actually what I'm struggling with, to be honest, is how is grabbing somebody by the waist who just had abdominal surgery a couple of days prior? I mean, I've had abdominal surgery, and I'm sure other people have. I mean, you are very sensitive after that, and you don't want anybody near you. How is grabbing somebody by the waist not causing that person harm?
Well, initially, Your Honor, I think my first response is, I think this goes to some of the issues related to the factual findings and how I think that there's reasons to think that they could be clearly erroneous. Because there is no evidence in the record supporting that the appellant has a history of abusing these children. The prior incidents of abuse cited in the record are related to the respondent. We dispute those and continue the dispute of those. But that's the first issue, I think, to sort of get to that. And then grabbing by the waist and hauling, I pulled the order back out. And grabbing means, you know, grabbing, it's clutching something. It's putting something in between your two hands, but that doesn't necessarily mean that is a vicious physical act resulting in harm. And hauling is respectfully a synonym of carrying. I think in this instance, it's meant to convey that there's a greater physicality to it than the cradling described by Mr. Homer in his testimony. But I don't think that those things in and of themselves, hauling and grabbing, as the district court describes it, are sufficient to meet the definition of physical harm. Because again, those actions have to be the thing that caused the harm.
Mr. Wallace, you know, your arguments today have focused in large part on the district court's finding that there was physical harm, which amounted to domestic abuse. But the district court also found independently that there was fear harm that could satisfy the definition of domestic abuse as well. And those findings, I haven't heard you discuss those. It seems to me that when the district court says that there was an infliction of fear of imminent physical harm due to the ongoing argument, which you don't dispute, and the quick manner in which your client picked up the child, which you don't dispute, and put her in the car while the petitioner, the mom's hand, was still in the car, that in and of itself would cause fear to the child to satisfy the definition of domestic abuse. Is there something clearly erroneous about those findings, or some abuse of discretion by the district court in those findings?
I believe so, Your Honor.
And what is that?
Thank you. there's no evidence to support that that's the case. There's no testimony from
that,
the child.
What's the case? I mean, there was an argument. He did pick her up quickly, and mom's arm was still in the car. What's erroneous about those findings?
That those things in and of themselves would cause fear for the child. There's no evidence to support that the child was in fear in this situation. I understand the court is, excuse me, I have something in my mouth. Excuse me. I don't see in the record here, and I understand the court is going to be deferential to the district court, that there is evidence supporting a imminent fear of harm for the child. I can understand how this would be an upsetting and certainly disturbing situation to witness as a child. But again, there's no testimony, there's no facts to support that is the case, and that was how the child was feeling at the time. The court is substituting and saying there's, you know, it's reasonable for a person to feel that way, and it certainly is, but there has to be actual facts to support that. Respectfully, Your Honor, I have 54 seconds left in counting. And so just going to ECH very briefly, what I wanted to point out was that this, as the court's aware, this child was not present. And what the respondent is asking the court to do is to adopt the dissenting opinion from Schmidt. And we believe that that would be an erroneous position and to continue to sustain those issues. And I'll address mootness and the other things in my rebuttal if I have time.
Mr. Wallace, for my benefit, what is the relief you're seeking with respect to ECH?
Well, at this point in time, the relief would be eventually a motion in district court for compensatory parenting time. We believe that including him through the quote other relief here was inappropriate given his lack of witnessing, lack of fear, and that this is clearly on point with Schmidt, and that Schmidt should control here, and that this child should not have been subject to the parenting time restrictions of the order for protection. And there are other remedies through the order for protection statute that could have been issued to address any concerns related to Ms. LeBlanc. So I'll leave that there, Your Honor. I don't want to impede on anybody else's time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you will now have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you're representing.
Benjamin Koss on behalf of respondent Gina LeBlanc. May it please the court, I come in this morning a slight bit disappointed because I wanted on the chance to expand on Schmidt a little bit, because I think that these facts did take and exploit or highlight the loophole created in Schmidt. But yes, nonetheless, we've conceded ECH wasn't present. We agree with that. And that, yes, the district court imposed relief that affected ECH, but the relief as it pertains to ECH has now been abandoned or vacated based upon the motion that was presented in May. So at this point, as stated in my brief, anything with regard to ECH is moot at this point. And I don't think that the court has to engage in any further analysis beyond that. With regard to the assertion by the appellant that the district court impermissibly relied on Thompson versus Scrimshire, I think that there's an attempt here to lose focus on what happened in 2021. I think that the court here heard the evidence, heard both parties talk about, okay, something happened in 2015 and 2018 But that's not where the court gave the greatest amount of weight to the evidence. The court focused on what happened on February 2021. It made the credibility determinations that it did and found that, yes, there is sufficient evidence with which to make a finding that domestic abuse occurred. Regardless of whether mom stuck her arm in the door in an attempt to defray the situation or Mr. O'Meara pulled it into the door, he still made the decision to hold her arm in the door and drive the car. That caused mom harm. Looking at the statute, yes, okay, we've got three options really that take and create domestic abuse. The district court here focused on options one or two. Did harm actually occur, or was there the imposition of fear? With regard to the child, GJH, I think that Justice Frisch must have been inside my mind this morning, because my argument was this is a totality of the circumstances type analysis, even though the statute doesn't say it. This whole situation, a 10-year-old girl looking at her parents tussling, being grabbed by the waist and placed in the car. Yes, I think that a reasonable person could take and conclude that with all these circumstances, a person would be frightened.
Mr. Kassa, I appreciate this argument, and it does follow up on the questioning that I posed to Mr. Wallace. His response is that there was no evidence presented to the district court providing a direct connection to the child's perception of fear as a result of these events as described by the district court. Do you want to address that? If there's case law that requires the child to testify or some other direct evidence to substantiate those conclusions by the district court?
The site case law, I mean, was the child obligated to testify? No, I don't believe the child was obligated to testify. I certainly think mom's impressions of the case saying these are the facts that I observed, I think go to show that this is how the child behaved. A person could reasonably take and interpret that that is fear. But as far as case law is concerned, I think that here I would probably take a look at Thompson versus Scrimshire to say these are the acts that of harm that have taken and occurred in the past. Okay. Additionally, and I think it's more to the preposition that either harm had to have occurred, that's one, because Thompson and Scrimshire squarely rebuffs, in my opinion, both Burgum and Cass. But I hear counsel's argument is saying that Ms. LeBlanc, in her pro se role, didn't establish the connection. I don't think that it was necessary for her to bring out the medical records in this case when both parties testified that they were aware that the child had been subject to a surgery. So,
Mr. Kassa, if you're directing us to Thompson, I mean, my understanding of the record from the 2015 incident was that it involved Ms. LeBlanc and not GJH. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So how would that provide any evidence or support with respect to GJH?
Because Thompson and Scrimshire, as I understood it, really removed, I think, that element of intent here, I think, is what did happen. So I think that that's what Burgum stood for, was we got to have intent. And Thompson said no. So that's why I'm citing it with regard to GJH, is because it eliminates that intent requirement. With regard, you're correct that the 2015 incident only involved mom and the appellant. And with regard to mom in this case, I think I've hit on it quite squarely here. I mean, the district court has said that you two have given me a similar timeline of events, and the district court expressed in writing, based upon what it heard out of both parties, this is what it believed happened, and did choose to say that domestic abuse had occurred.
Mr. Kassa, I want to go back to GJH, because didn't the district court need to find either actual harm or infliction of fear of imminent harm? I'm still curious as to the connection here, or maybe the lack thereof. Isn't there a lack of connection because you don't have the testimony from the child of fear? And what testimony directly points to there being fear? It seems to be a conclusory statement by the district court that of course she would have been in fear, but how can we assume that she would have been in fear? Shouldn't there be something in the record to show that she actually was in fear?
I would say in reviewing the record that, yeah, the court didn't make that finding. And as I reviewed the transcript, I don't recall one single statement by mother on Director Cross saying that GJH was afraid. I mean, in a sense, the child went with the father. The child forced the father into the car. And from the moment of putting the child in the car, okay, yeah, how was mom reasonably going to be able to view the child's emotional condition? She had to take and somehow make that connection a couple days later when she picked up GJH that harm had occurred. And I think that is where I hear the point about the infliction of fear, but I think that's where mom was relying on the fact that there was actual injury that occurred.
But those are two separate issues. It sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't recall seeing anything in the record to support a finding of fear. It seems like that's just the district court saying, of course she would have been in fear. Any reasonable person would, but I don't think that's the standard. I think we need to have something in the record. So it sounds like you're more relying on the harm. So if you're relying on harm, I mean, is there enough in the record to show that she actually did incur physical harm or bodily injury?
I would contend that there is enough in the record from start to finish, the couple days before that Friday the 12th, the parties knowing that she'd gone in surgery, the grabbing by the waist, the putting in the car, followed by the subsequent trip to the hospital. It was one portion of it. And so I think that even if there had been other causes that contributed to the hospital stay, that yes, those could be put in, but maybe those other causes don't come into play here. So, and that's been appellant's assertion all along, which is, well, mom never called anybody from the hospital and there were no records that were introduced whatsoever at the time of trial.
Well,
go ahead, Judge Fish.
Isn't the act of grabbing the child an assault within the meaning of the statute, though? Isn't that enough?
Yes, it would be. It's the equivalent of grabbing Humpty Dumpty. You know Humpty Dumpty is damaged. You know that you have to exercise reasonable care when grabbing Humpty Dumpty. So the act of grabbing when you know that Humpty Dumpty is injured, yes, that should take and constitute domestic abuse in this case. Or underneath the statute, which is what your question was. With that, Your Honors, I mean, quite frankly, I think I've plainly laid out my position in the rest of my brief. I think with regard to GJH, I think that at this juncture, yes, she has the order for protection against her, but she is in a fairly similar position to ECH at this point, which is that father now has access to both children. One, GJH, who was the subject of the order for protection, and ECH, who is not. So I think as a practical matter, the appellant is in as good a position as he was at the start of this when it comes to his children. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel for Appellant, you will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Your Honors, I froze.
That's okay. We can still hear you. We do realize that you are frozen, but if you want to proceed, we can hear you clearly. So let us know what you would like to do.
I'm fine proceeding if you are. I just wanted to point that out.
Okay.
So thank you. What I wanted to say in rebuttal to Mr. Casa is essentially on the issue of mootness that he raises in his brief is that the issues here are not moot. A finding of the domestic abuse as it relates to the child GJH is something that can and would affect his substantial rights going forward. Mootness calls into question, and I think is very well laid out in a criminal case, State v. Brooks, in which the court articulated that an exception to mootness and the doctrine of mootness is whether or not there's an error here capable of being repeated. And whether or not, in this particular case, there are errors that are capable of being repeated. I believe that there are. One, as it relates to the child GJH, the court's substitution of its belief for that of actual testimony as it relates to ECH.
Mr. Wallace, I believe that the mootness argument only pertains to the parenting time issue because the district court modified that order. And so issues with respect to the limitation of parenting time are now moot. I don't think Mr. Casa is arguing that the mootness doctrine applies to any other aspect of this matter.
He's nodding his head, but his closing comments made it sound like he did. So I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. As it relates to the parenting time, I mean, this was several months where my client had essentially very limited contact with his children. And that is harm to their relationship, especially given the limited nature of the parenting time in the first place and the distance between the children and their father in this particular case. So I do believe that the issues as it relates to ECH are not moot.
So then the question is now that the district court has vacated that order, what remedy do you seek from us with respect to parenting time? Because there's not anything that we can undo because it's already been undone.
Well, Your Honors, if Your Honors make a finding that the child should not have been subject to this order for protection, because under Schmidt, you need to be a victim of domestic abuse in order to receive relief under an order for protection, then the position would be that the courts then, I believe, the Court of Appeals would be saying that your order in district court was erroneous, and therefore the parenting time should not have been restricted, and my client would be due compensatory time for the time that was missed with that child and possibly GJH, depending upon other findings made by the court in its order following this hearing and due consideration of the briefs. Going back to GJH for just a moment here, there's a lot tied up in the words grabbing and hauling versus carrying. And they are, in a certain sense, I believe, synonyms. Carrying and hauling, you haul furniture, you carry furniture. You grab things, you pick things up. They're very similar words. And synonyms in most sentences and circumstances. There's a lot of import being put on them in this particular case. And I believe that that goes to the issues and to whether or not there is domestic abuse as it relates to GJH under the statute.
Mr. Wallace, we often refer to the Merriam-Webster dictionary, and you mentioned that carry and haul are synonyms, but when I look up the word haul under the Merriam-Webster dictionary, it says drag, draw, hail, lug, pull, tow, and tug. And those don't sound like synonyms to me, but I actually had a question that I wanted to follow up with respect to the district court order that you pointed to, where it says grabbing her by the waist and hauling her to the car meets the definition of domestic abuse in the present sense due to her abdominal surgery 2 days previously. The definition of domestic abuse includes assault. Can you address why this would not be considered an assault?
Well, Your Honors, frankly, the words, I mean, just starting at the beginning and going forward, the words, I think, carry, haul, grab, are all interrelated. And with that being said, moving forward to your direct question, which is how is grabbing not an assault? Assault or grab, if the issue here is how the child is touched, for lack of a better way to put it, is I think the question. And grabbing in and of itself doesn't cause an injury. The injury that results here is the abscess. The abscess, as Ms. LeBlanc testified to, is an infection. An infection that could have resulted from this surgical procedure anyway, could have been present at the time the child was grabbed. If the grab itself, and I don't care for the word, but if the grab itself is what we're hinging the finding of domestic abuse on, then the grab has to be what caused the injury. And there's no evidence to support that there's an injury that resulted from this grab and this hauling. The abscess that Ms. LeBlanc testified to could have been present the entire time. The testimony from that she related from the medical professionals is that whatever Mr. Homer did didn't help anything. That is not a causal connection between the grabbing and the injury. I don't believe the statute supports that there's an imminent fear of physical harm. There's no place for a judge to make a reasonable person determination under the statute. There has to be direct evidence and testimony of that. So then we come to the issue of physical harm, as you point out, Your Honor, and there's no evidence that the grabbing caused the harm. There has to be this connection. So with that, Your Honor, I would conclude, unless there's other questions.
No, I don't. It looks like there aren't any other questions. That wasn't actually an answer to my direct question, but I do appreciate the response. Thank you both for your oral arguments and your briefing. Very well done.